Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 23rd, 2014, and welcome to episode 88 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans, your host from the Left Coast in Portland, Oregon. Today we have a special guest, and this means a couple of things. First, we're pushing back our coverage of 1988. If you've been listening the last few episodes, you know that during our episodes numbered in the 80s, we've been covering that corresponding year in the 80s. So we're going to mix 88 and 89 together in the next episode. So don't worry, the things that happened in 1988 will not be forgotten. Also, we won't have some of our regular features like gift guide and eBay auction today. For those things, stay tuned for next time. Now, before I introduce our guest, let's take a quick roll call of our regular irregulars. From our affiliate station in Boston, we have Paul Hagstrom. Paul, good afternoon.
Hello all.
How are you doing today?
Things are pretty good here. In the midst of doing a lot of same stuff as always, disk imaging and cleaning and testing old machines. It's a lot of fun, but there's a lot of them.
Excellent. Keeps you out of trouble. And now, moving around the time zones to Stockholm, Sweden, in our RCR plan for world domination, we're trying to capture all possible latitudes. So, Jack Netting, how are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. The end of a pretty relaxing weekend, and just taking it easy and getting ready to dig into this with Ben here.
Awesome. And Michael, coming to us from Australia, where it's technically tomorrow, and maybe you can let us know the lottery numbers for tomorrow. How are you doing, Michael?
Oh, pretty good, but I thought this was today and you're calling me from yesterday.
It's so much easier to talk to yesterday, though, than it is to talk to tomorrow. Yesterday's already happened, but tomorrow's yet to come.
Let's just call it an all-encompassing present. But, had fun and games. Went out and bought a new portable generator because of a big blackout that we had last weekend. Uh-huh. And, of course, it was lots of fun getting that all put together in the 45-degree heat here in beautiful, sunny, springtime Sydney. But, really looking forward to summer where it'll just start warming up a little bit more.
Is that 45 Celsius or Fahrenheit? I'm confused.
In Fahrenheit, that's 115.
Oh!
It's amazing temperatures.
Yeah, balmy weather down here.
And now, since he's jumped in, let me go ahead and introduce our guest. Today we're very pleased to have Ben Heckendorn, a.k.a. Ben Heck, electronics guru, maker extraordinaire. Ben, welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. I've always enjoyed the Ben Heck Show. I have to say I'm really happy and impressed by your following. Some of the information that I got on the show, you've got 285,000 YouTube subscribers, more than 15.5 million views. Holy cow. I'd say keep it up. That's the way we got our start.
Yeah. I mean, we're not quite up there with cat videos yet, but we're trying.
So I already know this answer, but for the benefit of our listeners, what do you do on the Ben Heck Show?
Well, the Ben Heck Show is sponsored by Element 14, which is an electronics distributor. So they like it when we build cool electronic devices. And the basic premise is if people send in ideas like, hey, could you try to build this? Or, you know, if, usually if there's some sort of interesting need, we like that, like, oh, my grandma's disabled and she can't do such and such. Could you build a device? So we take those requests and then we see if we can build it in the time that we have. And we do an episode every week. And sometimes the builds or what we build might take 2 weeks or sometimes even 3 weeks. But we build a lot of cool stuff. Some of the stuff isn't as cool as other things, but as long as people keep watching, I guess that's the important thing.
Well, it's always fun. Sometimes it's modern day stuff, but sometimes it has to do with vintage computers, which is our stock and trade on the RCR. You've done some great builds with a variety of these things, Commodores, Atari, Spectrum, maybe others that I didn't even catch. And now, of course, the Apple One, which we're going to dig into in some detail in the show. But I'm just curious, before we jump into that, what inspires your interest in vintage computers? How'd that come about?
Well, I had an Atari 800 when I was a kid.
The 800.
Yes, I still have it, actually. I mean, there's no way in a million years we would have afforded an IBM of any shape or size back then. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the one that I had. And then also, you know, so I was born in 75, so I spent most of my life in the 80s until, you know, the 90s were over. So, yeah, not just the Atari, but, you know, we had the, I think we even had some Commodores in grade school, which is kind of odd, I mean, because it's mostly Apples. But, yeah, we had those and we had the Apples, and I just kind of grew up with it. And, like, with the Spectrum, obviously that's a UK computer, but I still found it very interesting.
So there's a soft spot in your heart for these computers, basically.
Yeah, definitely. It was kind of... computers were like magical back then. Nowadays, you know, you have the entire internet in the palm of your hand. It's like, yeah, whatever. It's commonplace. Back then, it was loading a tape and typing Claude and waiting 15 minutes to play Hangman. There was, you know, we'd never really seen anything like that before. So it was new, even though it was pretty primitive. And you actually felt like you had, I don't want to say ownership with the computer. You know, like if you can't open it, you don't own it. Not really into that, but you felt like you were part of it, like you could write a program at the same level that the operating system was written at, and you could just push reset and start over if you had to.
Yep, I agree. And we've talked about how that kind of dovetails into the makerspace of today. It's one of the questions that I'll have for you toward the end. But let's chat about the Apple One replica that you just made. So aside from the Apple that was on your desk in the video, which I suspect was a prop, what prompted you to build an Apple One work alike?
Okay, well, what prompted me, I guess you'd have to kind of dial it back a little bit. I always say this in interviews, so I'm sure people are like, ugh, it's like flashbacks. It was like probably about a year ago, and I was just on Twitter, and I'm like, hey, I want to do something with the Spectrum. Anyone has one? Because they're actually hard to find in America, even if you go on eBay, unlike most old crap. I mean, old, amazing computers. So anyway, someone from Ireland sent me one, and I was like, I'd really like to do a project with this, so... Like earlier in the summer, we started doing the ZX Spectrum project, and then we were also going to England in the end of August. So I'm like, oh, this is a perfect thing to take to England on our trip. So I really enjoyed doing that, like doing an 8-bit computer project, and I wired the entire thing by hand, which is insane. But well, I didn't think it was insane, but some people might think it's insane. And I really enjoyed doing that project. So I was like, wow, you know, I like I said, I'm a big fan of classic computers. So I was like, I'd like to do another one. So then I pitched the idea of making a replica Apple One. I hadn't had to explain it, you know, to the producers and whatnot. I'm like, well, before the Apple II, there was an Apple One and it was a kit. And nowadays, people make replicas of it because it's a very simple computer. So then we did that whilst we were moving our shop. We moved our shop to a larger location here in Madison, Wisconsin. And, so it was kind of a straightforward project that also gave us a little bit of breathing room for our move. But I did the same thing again. I made a 6502 single board computer board, and then I made an add-on module that actually had the PIA, the peripheral interface adapter, and the video generator was on a separate chip, which is pretty much what I did with the ZX Spectrum, whereas I made a single board Z80 computer, made sure that worked using the oscilloscope, and then I attached what actually made it a Spectrum, which is its ULA circuit and external RAM. I like doing old computer stuff, and whenever I can sneak it into a show episode, I do. And it seems like people enjoy it as well, the viewers, I mean.
Well, it's
neat to see how simple that the old computers were. I mean, you know, in terms of their architecture and that, it didn't seem to take you very long to put it together. But that is a question that we have. So your videos, by necessity, kind of condense time. I mean, you can't, you know,
big time,
put somebody through 3-4 days worth of videos. So, but how long would you say in reality, like real time, that the Apple One project took you to build?
It took 3 weeks.
Ah, okay. And, you know, some of the things that you had in there, your typical maker might not have unless they have access to a hackerspace or a makerspace like the CNC machine and that kind of thing. But it looked like the circuit itself for the Apple One was simple enough that if somebody wanted to take it on and use what you did as a template, that they'd be able to do it. What do you think about that? Do you think that'd be possible?
Well, there's a sliding scale of what people consider to be easy. Definitely. The Apple One, it's a lot simpler than like the ZX Spectrum, for instance. Well, the thing is, they sell kits. Like, there's companies that make things they call like the Replica One. They sell kits where you can populate and build your own Apple One replica. So you don't need to wire it. You just populate the chips and it works. And I think they're pretty reasonably priced, like $200. I mean, I think, I do the things that I do because I'm really hardcore. Like, I'll wire an entire 8-bit computer by hand just because I'm hardcore. I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't recommend that for everyone. And I'm not trying to say that because, oh, I can solder better than you. It's more that someone tries that, they may not succeed. And they're like, oh, you know, then they'll be disgruntled about it.
I see. So, yeah, so the complexity differs. So what you're thinking is, don't jump in over your head, get discouraged, and then walk away from electronics because of that or be irritated. I mean, you probably want to progress through a series of things before you tackle a big project.
Well, I would say do it in a breadboard form or, you know, like a experimenter socket where you stick in all your chips and then you use a butt ton of leads to make the circuit. Because then you can actually fix it and change it. If you try to immediately hand solder a very small, compact 8-bit computer without a PCB, if you make one mistake, you might be like, oh, I don't know where the mistake is. I give up. And a lot of people do give up on projects very quickly. I mean, we probably don't, but a lot of people do. So that's something you have to kind of assume might happen and try to why do I have a Blockbuster video card on my desk? Look at this. I'm going to throw that away. Goodbye.
Gotcha.
Sorry about that. wow, it's completely useless. anyway, so I guess my thing, I tend to anticipate what might be difficult or frustrating for people. And when I'm asked where to start, I usually tell people to start simple.
That makes sense.
And what is it? 6502.org is a really great site with a lot of single board 6502 computer designs and schematics and whatnot.
Yes.
Do your research first. Although it's a very, you know, it's like, what, 1 megahertz? So you don't have to worry about high frequency issues with your board design like you would with, you know, a modern computer.
So you think something like that Apple One replica might work on a solderless breadboard?
Oh, yeah, there's no reason you couldn't do it. Again, it's like 1 megahertz. You don't have to worry about the issues you'd have with high frequency devices. I just knew I could do it, so I just immediately wired it the way I wanted it. Actually, when we do things in the show, I have an assistant. I have an electronics assistant, Felix, and I always encourage him to breadboard things before he does a PCB. It's like, make sure it works, test it, then spend the time designing the PCB. Instead of designing the time with the PCB, making a PCB with the laser, blah, 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 and then it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Fail quickly and often, I guess would be my advice.
Very good. So, Paul, it looks like you had a couple of questions.
Oh, well, I guess, so I've had a little bit of experience with some of the, there's a particular thing, the Replica One that you were mentioning that Brielle Computers makes. I've built a couple of those. And in that machine, basically, there's a modern interface to modern keyboards, you know, so I think my thought when I was seeing your Apple One remake, whatever, what should I call that?
Whatever you want.
Hack, mod. But a lot of the effort went into the keyboard matrix. I think I might have stopped one step shorter and just left it with the serial interface. But at that level, I would think.
Oh, it had probably to have a keyboard, though.
Yeah, well.
Well, so what's your question?
Oh, well, there were a couple, but the comment was basically just, I think probably the project would be pretty achievable at a pretty basic level if you stopped at step two, if you just wanted to make the breadboard that communicated with the 6502 and
had the room.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I'm not scared of hand wiring or matrix or laser cutting keys. I knew I could do it, so I did it. But yeah, you're right. There's definitely a cliff level of difficulty at that point. The one thing I will bring up, so I wanted to build a laptop, and I've made it all wood because, there's that, quintessential photo of the Apple One that has, the wooden case, and they routed the word Apple into it really rough. So I'm like, well, people think of that when they think of these old kit computers, so I have to make it, wood. I laser cut the wood, and I stained it to be nice and dark. So it was important for me to have that aesthetic because it's not just about building an old computer, at least the way I build things. It's about sparking the emotion of nostalgia because, 99% of everything is nostalgia these days. It's not just the fact that it's an old computer. It looks like an old computer. And even if the old Apple didn't look like that, well, it was a kit, so it looked like whatever people wanted it to look like. But it made you think of that, like the wood grain and the dark colors and console hi-fi stereo in your living room kind of look.
Oh, I was going to say, it's beautiful. I mean, it turned out very well. It
had a really good steampunk kind of vibe to it, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. That wasn't really my intent, but I'm glad you like that. Yeah, I had Felix sand the... We got 3 millimeter plywood, or 1/8. And I'm like, sand this smooth as a baby's butt. And then we'll make the surfaces of the machine with that. You mentioned the modern keyboard or the matrix, and I did the same thing the Replica One did. I used the parallax propeller because it's a microcontroller I'm very familiar with. I used that to do the video interface just like they did, but they were using that with a PS2 keyboard because it's very simple to hook a PS2, PS/2, not PlayStation 2. Oh, why am I explaining that to you guys? I'm sorry. Keyboard, it's really easy to connect that keyboard up to a parallax propeller, but USB, no. The thing is, finding a PS2 keyboard that would be small enough and appropriate for a machine like that would have been very difficult. So I was like, I'll just write my own keyboard matrixing routine and send that to the Apple rather than try to find a keyboard that's small enough. So those are the kind of things I do that a lot of people might not do, but that's just how I roll. So... But, I also design pinball machines, so making a scanned matrix of keys or switches it's easy. It's easy as pie for me, so, but not Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, that's good. That's sort of that's too sophisticated.
It has too many
built in.
Yeah, I also, I thought it was really fun to find the memory map of the Apple One and create a ROM that had everything already preloaded and then map it to memory. Like the WAS monitor at the top of memory, and then there's a compiler you can get that you can put just below the WAS monitor, and then you had to put BASIC in a certain area. So some of that stuff I did kind of my own way because I took it's a 6502, which means that's 65K of addressable space or 65535 bytes. So the top half of it, I imagine the original Apple, it had the top was ROM, then they had some BASIC below the ROM, then they had some BASIC at the bottom of memory. So I just took a 32K EEPROM because I had some laying around, and I mapped it to the second half of memory, which is where all the resident programs would be, like a set loader or BASIC. And then I just did a byte offset where I put all of the the BASIC. It was really hard to dig up the old BASIC for that. I guess it was only recently rediscovered or rescanned. It was lost for decades. But anyway, so you put that in a certain area of memory. You put the WAS monitor at the top of memory. So then when the system boots, obviously the 6502 vectors to 65534, I believe, is its reset vector. So it finds – no, I'm sorry. It's actually 4 bytes below. Anyway, so I it was really fun for me to sit there in a hex editor and arrange these chunks of hex to fit in the memory map. That's really geeky, but I really enjoyed it.
So that must take a decent amount of time also, all of that software hackery and trickery that you're doing.
Not really. Basically, you look at the memory map, and so 32K would be 8,000 in hex. And you just look at where the things are supposed to be in memory, and then you subtract 8,000 from them, and then you put them in the same memory using a hex editor. So you just basically just make a 32 kilobyte empty hex file. And then you're like, okay, so at location 0C100, we need to have the cassette loading routine, which is only 256 bytes. Basic sits at, I think it was D000, and it's exactly 4K. It probably only took me about an hour or two to arrange all that.
One of the things that I was wondering about was kind of what you knew about the machines going in versus what you kind of like learned going through the process of rebuilding them. So how did your understanding, respect, or whatever deepen in this process, if it did?
With the Apple One or with any 8-bit computer?
Well, with any of these. I mean, so I know you've done a number of them, which I think we'll probably touch on as well, you know, apart from the Apple One, also the Spectrum and even, you know, Atari computers and things. But I'm just kind of wondering to what extent this was a learning experience for you and it actually getting that deep into the design or redesign.
You know, I was programming Atari in like 86 or 87. So, you know, I was familiar with memory maps and all that, although I obviously understand a lot, but more now than I did back then. I'm like, wow, if only I knew what I know now when I was 11, I could make much better programs as a kid. I would say one thing that really impressed me going in, the Spectrum is a good example. I mean, well, the Apple One is like just ridiculously basic of a computer. The Spectrum was really impressive, and I even continued to learn more things about it after I built it. It's a Z80, which again has a 64K address space, and it was done so cheaply. I mean, like they pinched every penny they could on that thing. It was like compared to like any other 8-bit computer, it's so simple. And that was really impressive, you know, how it had two separate banks of memory and like one bank of memory was optional and everything on it was stock except for the ULA. And even that was kind of stock because I'm like, oh, it's a ULA. It's the video. It's the, you know, it's a display driver chip for the Spectrum. And then it was when I was in England and I was talking to, you know, tons of people who had the computers as a kid, unlike us Americans. And they're like, well, ULA is the uncommitted logic array. And I'm like, oh, really? And they're like, yeah. It was kind of like the FPGA of its time. You'd get this, it was basically a silicon mask, and like the first 8 layers are like just a general purpose array of logic elements. And to customize it, you basically attach a top layer which can connect certain things to other things, and that creates a custom chip out of it. So even the custom chip in the Spectrum was fairly standard. So yeah, anyway, so that was something I was learning about it even after I'd finished doing it. It's also the unobtainium part. They're very hard to find, the ULA chip, although people have done FPGA implementations of it. Although at that point, you might as well just do the whole computer in FPGA.
That's been one of the questions that floats around the retro computer community. If you're going to make a modern add-on for one of these computers or simulate one of the parts, then why not simulate the whole thing? I guess the answer we always come up with is we're really interested in the old computers and running as much of the old computer as we can. It's just that sometimes you do bump into those parts that are really hard to get. Like for the Commodore 64, the SID chips are pretty expensive these days, the sound interface chip, because they were so popular that people actually extracted them from Commodores and put them in other add-on boards and that kind of thing, and now they're kind of tough to find. So,
and the musicians got into that, like all this, you know, hip-hop and who's that, Lady Gaga. When they actually would make synthesis cards for computers with actual SID chips in them. So they would remake modern synthesizers using SID chips, contributing to the shortage. But again, why not just make it an FPGA?
Right. Did you find it hard to dig up a 6502 for your project? Or?
Oh, not at all. Just get it off eBay.
Okay. And the other chip that you had in there, the PIA, was that just a stock
eBay
chip that you... Okay. eBay. We spend a lot of time on eBay ourselves. So.
See, here's the thing. Like, you're talking about the SID chip, and obviously that was in the Commodore 64, which was, don't tell Apple, the best-selling 8-bit computer of all time. But even then, it was only in Commodore 64s. But the 6502, it was in, obviously, the Commodore, the Atari, the Apple II, and other things. Every Cherry Master game you see at a bar being played by an old woman smoking Pall Malls. So things, parts like also the PIA, the peripheral interface adapter, That was used in a ton of computers and game consoles as well. So it's kind of like if you think about like the modern console wars, for instance, with the, you know, Sony and Microsoft. It's like, oh, you know, there's they sold Wii is the top selling console from, you know, the last generation, just like Commodore was a top selling console. But why aren't there more of the special SID chips? Well, all told, yeah, it was the top-selling console, but the other two consoles sold more than it combined. So just because there's a ton of something like a Commodore 64, that doesn't mean its parts going to be in infinite supply. The common parts between all of those are actually going to be much more common. So yeah, you can go on eBay right now. But you guys have trouble finding 6502s and Z80s?
No, I haven't actually gone out to look.
You can still buy. They still make the Z80, for crying out loud.
That's true. And I think they don't make the 6502 in its original form, but I think Western Design still makes a modern, what would you say, incarnation of the 6502. So
they're the ones who made the CPU on the Apple IIgs, right? Western Design?
I think so, the 65816.
And that's also the same thing in the Super Nintendo.
That I don't know, but...
yeah, it's the same. The 2GS has the same CPU, which makes you kind of wonder if the Super Nintendo was supposed to have a backwards compatibility mode. Because Apple 2GS did. You know, you could run 2GS 16-bit software on it, or 8-bit Apple software, or Apple II software.
So let's say that we were able to grab these chips. I think some of us would be interested. Let me back up a little bit. You're sponsored by Element 14. Yet naturally, I've done business with them. I bought electronic components and that kind of thing. My Raspberry Pi, my Pi Face control, and I've bought stuff from Element 14. You know, they want people to buy stuff from them. So if we wanted to go buy parts and do something like this, we might need a template or something. I think Michael has a related question to that.
Yeah, I was just wanting to know, do you make any of your associated code and design notes for your projects available?
Yeah, they're all on the Element 14. Yeah, they're on the Element 14 website.
Okay, so to the Element 14 website. Okay, because watching the Apple One replica, I was interested in the propeller code that we're using for the peripheral support.
Yep. So that was already online, but we'll also reproduce our files as well. Although I rewrote it, I didn't. Not to sound natty, but I didn't feel that the existing propeller code to interface with the Apple One was very well written. So I rewrote a lot of it myself.
Gotcha. And was that in Spin, in the propeller's native language, or was that in C, or do you recall?
It was in Spin, and then it used assembly for the video driver portions.
Okay.
Yeah, so Spin works. We actually use a propeller on our the pinball system that we sell. It's because it's great for audio video because it has 8 cores, which also makes it good for... I actually think the propeller could probably emulate the PIA itself. You could probably omit the peripheral interface adapter if you wrote code entirely in assembly on a propeller. I just haven't gotten around to doing it, and I probably won't. So I think some of the replicas are a little kludgy. They probably could use fewer components. Of course, I'll always say that about just about anything.
Well, did the propeller run the shift registers in that would accept the input from the keyboard?
Oh, well, okay, so the propeller has, you basically get an object, you would get the PS2 keyboard object, and then you would basically just literally plug in a PS2 keyboard into the propeller, and then the propeller, if I see a key on keyboard, send to Apple, and vice versa.
So right.
It doesn't use a metric, you know, ton of shift registers like the actual Apple One did, because its display memory was actually created out of shift registers, which is insane.
Yeah, I saw that on your on the videos for the Apple One replica. That was really you never quite knew what Woz was going to do, what sort of innovative creation he was going to make. We were curious how you solve things like the keyboard debounce problem, which is why I was curious how the keyboard interfaced to the whole darn thing.
I just assigned a timer for every key in an array of... the way I do debounce is if there's... I don't know how many keys are on that keyboard, like 70. You create an array of 70 shorts, and then you assign a timer to each key. So if the key is pressed... a certain amount of time must elapse before it can be re-triggered or before it repeats. So it's done in software.
Gotcha. I was wondering if you just use some sort of timer to handle that debounce problem, which
you can do it with circuitry, but you know, in this modern microcontroller age, there's no, really no reason to do it with anything but code.
Well, so with the one other little, you know, seriously propeller head, if you'll pardon the pun, question here, with the rows and the columns on the keyboard, the way you laid out that matrix, what happens if somebody presses two letter keys?
Because there's no diode. Isn't a diode on every button?
Right.
Well, the way they do it on a, like if you take apart a modern keyboard, they're all basically made out of garbage. They all have silkscreen circuit, you know, because it's cheap. And they have one silkscreen circuit, and then it folds together, and there's a little bit of spacer in between it. And I actually like cheap keyboards like that. I don't like expensive mechanical keyboards. They're too noisy. I already hit keys hard enough. Anyway, so if you want true independent key presses, you have to have a diode on every key or every button in a matrix. What they do in a modern keyboard is the matrix is arranged in such a way that you probably won't. So if there are keys, you're going to commonly push at the same time, like Control-Alt-Delete or Shift-Control-S. Those are all separated into their own rows and columns. So even if you press them at the same time, it won't cause a problem. Also, on the keyboard that we did, I only had like 3 I.O. left on the propeller, which it was either 3 or 4 I.O. So I actually used you're right. I did use shift registers for that. I thought you were talking about the shift registers in the original Apple One. I'm sorry. So yeah, the way I did it to conserve I.O., was I had a 74HC595 serial output shift register. I'm sorry, parallel output shift register, and then a really common 4021 input shift register. And I would actually send the row data out. Oh, I'm sorry, I would send the column data out, like, you know, which column should be active. I would send that out and clock in the result at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that way I could do it with, I had the data out, data in, clock, and latch. So you could actually combine the clock and latch lines and save two pins. The only problem is then you're one step behind in the cycle because, like, the data you get after you send – the data you get is from the previous cycle, so you have to actually, like, desynchronize your cycles by one in order to actually make it line up into your matrix. And then it just says – basically, there's a arrays in memory of what the keys are. So you're like, okay, well, if I'm on column 0 and bit whatever is set on the data I'm getting back, then I know it's a letter M, for instance.
Mm.
As far as like pushing multiple keys at once, if you push enough, you would cause one key to high priority. So you would see, like, if you press like J and M at the same time, you would see just M.
Gotcha. Because of the way it's cycling through that matrix,
only one column is active at a time.
Perfect.
Actually, I wired it almost identical to how the ZX Spectrum. The ZX Spectrum keyboard matrixing was laughably primitive. It's tied into the address bus. It's just insane. Like,
oh, like, seriously?
Seriously.
Just directly hacked in.
Yep, like the so what they do, so on a CPU, you can call a register, basically something that's, you know, not on the address bus. So I can't remember what port it was. I can't remember if it's called a register port, but I think it's like FE or something. So if you call port FE internally, it will access. Actually, the Spectrum only has one port on it, and that port was used for keyboard scanning, tape input, and audio output, and setting the color. It's insane how cheap that thing was made.
I was chatting with some electronics hobbyists last night on a chat room, and we were trying to decide who was more thrifty in their designs, Jack Tramiel at Commodore or Clive Sinclair. And it sounds like Clive Sinclair is starting to win that battle.
Oh, God. I've worked with both systems. Clive Sinclair by a country mile. No, let me explain this to you. If you access a port on a CPU, it's like an internal port, and usually you get like 255 ports. So the Spectrum just had one port, which is located at FE, so it was near the top of the, you know, page 0. So what you would do is you would actually make a call, like, let's say it's in hex, you would make a call of, let me back that up. So FE would be, you know, so let's say you called, let's just say for the sake of argument, F0FE. So you'd make address line 15 high, and then of course the lower 7 through 0 in the address would be the FE that you indicated. So the system doesn't give a crap about the high byte. That is just used to make lines high. So it actually scans the keyboard by making address 15 high, then address 14, then 13. So basically, picture like the top 8 lines in the address bus being used to drive the columns of the keyboard. And then there were 5 rows, and those were fed into the ULA, and those were picked up in the lower byte. So yes, to scan the keyboard, it used the address bus. It was Yeah, there's no way Commodore was cheaper than the Sinclair Spectrum. Because I was looking at the schematics and trying to figure out how everything worked, and I'm like, I couldn't believe it. Sorry for the profanity. My mind was not blown. I was impressed, though. Like, my God. Because that thing was 200 pounds in the 80s, and I don't know what the exchange rate was. So basically, it was the cheapest computer on the planet. It didn't even have a power switch, for crying out loud.
Yeah, if you plugged it in, it was on. I guess was the switch. Oh, man, that's hilarious. So, the mind boggles at how you would even, so they must have had an interrupt process. And when you were doing the keyboard scan interrupt, because, I mean, you actually use the address lines for other cool things, like addressing memory. So...
Yeah, I don't have the schematics right in front of me. It basically, yeah, when you – oh, I know what it was. So when you access that port, it would cause the ULA to come online, because in any system, you know, a chip has an output enable or a chip enable. When its output enable is disabled, mm-hmm. everything goes tri-state, so it doesn't really – it doesn't assert anything on its bus, but it's affected by the other buses. So when you go to port FE – so basically – as long as there's an FE in the lower part of memory and it's on the port, that will activate the ULA. So the ULA just basically ignores the top 8 lines of the address, which is probably how that works. And since, you know, your memory or your video bus, if none of that is active, it's also going to ignore the top of memory. So, yeah, go for it, I guess. It worked. I mean, there's a few kludgy things. Oh, like the video chip actually drives the CPU in that machine as well. You put like 16 megahertz into it, which is divided down for the pixel clock, which is weird because it's a PAL. And then that's subdivided again for the 4 megahertz CPU clock. Yeah, again, super cheap. Actually, there's one thing about it that's not cheap. It actually has 2 banks of RAM, one for the video and then an extra bank. Because if you bought that thing cold turkey, like dirt cheap, it only had 16K of RAM. The first 8K of which were actually video memory, so it only had 8K of free RAM. But then it had 8 sockets to install more RAM if you wanted, which would bump it up to 48K, I think. Yes.
Gotcha. Some folks are typing questions. We're all kind of clamoring here. I think, Jack, you actually had a question about how these projects come about for Ben.
I've been looking at some of the descriptions of your projects as I've come across them. You know, I sort of stumble across your things now and then on the web, like, oh, this is cool. And I see some of the times you're talking about that you're building things for a customer. And I'm just wondering kind of, you know, what portion of your work is customer-driven and what portion is this is something that I just want to do and want to build this? And has that changed over time? Are you moving towards – I assume as you're getting more successful and getting more people aware of what you're doing, you get more customers asking for things. But I'm just curious, like, sort of what that ratio sort of looks like and how that's changing over time and what you think about that.
Okay. Yeah, well – even a lot of my friends don't know exactly what I do for a living, so it's not that uncommon of a question. Typically, we spend about 80% of the time working on the Ben Heck Show. A lot of work does go into it, either from a production standpoint, which I'm not really involved with, but the projects we build, there's a lot of prep work. And you're right, like whatever you see on camera, like 5 times that happened off camera, it's like the tip of an iceberg. Mm-hmm. As far as what I do on other things... typically anymore, I mostly work with larger companies on projects. I do a lot of stuff with the video game industry and controllers, latency testing, promotional items. I do, however, I didn't do it for a while this year, but I am getting back into making the accessibility controllers. Many years ago, there's someone who would, I don't know, I lost a limb in Iraq or something. And he's like, well, I'm back and I can't play video games because I only have one arm. And I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that would be a problem. So I came up with this controller that would allow him to do everything with one hand. And since then, I've made quite a few of those. And we actually restarted another batch yesterday. So as far as just like random people contacting me for projects, pretty much the only one I do in that case are these accessibility and disability controllers, because those are kind of a commodity item. It's like, it's for the Xbox One and it's for the left hand. You know, it's, you can like pigeonhole it and make it quickly. So like the days of people contracting me to do like Commodore 64 laptops, that kind of hasn't happened in quite a while. Mostly because the show takes up a lot of time and,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's simpler just to, you know, do a few things and try to do a bunch of different things. But it is fun on the show when I get the opportunity to do something like, you know, build the Xbox One laptop. It's not that I don't enjoy doing those things. Is that they are time consuming and, you know, going from like just building things one off for people all the time, which is what I did for quite a while, to having a show with a schedule that has, it's pretty rigid. It kind of limits what you can do. I also design pinball machines that are being manufactured.
Right. Jack, did you have something else about the Sinclair stuff?
Yeah, this is something that I wondered since you brought it up here. You know, I grew up, I'm just a couple years older than you, grew up in the U.S.
in the 80s.
And I remember, you know, we didn't have the Spectrum anywhere, but there was this Timex Sinclair 1000. Like, I know that there's very clearly a superficial relationship between this and the Spectrum, and I imagine a technical one as well. But, like, I remember as a kid, if I knew anyone who had a Timex Sinclair 1000, like, I felt sorry for them. And I had an Atari 400, and I was like, wow, that thing is not even a computer. But the Spectrum was a very, like, extremely popular and, I assume, quite capable device compared to the Timex Sinclair 1000. I just wondered, you may have sort of poked at both of these things, I guess. Is there how much are these things related? Do you know?
I know a little bit about it. I can't remember who gave me one, but someone gave me a Timex Sinclair Spectrum many years ago. And it, even back then, you know, when I was like a teenager and, you know, didn't have any money, I was like, this thing sucks. Now I use it as a prop for a high school movie skit. That's about all I ever give it. I don't even know where it is. It's probably at my mom's house someplace. As far as the difference, there was a Spectrum before the ZX Spectrum. I think it was like the Z1 or the ZX1. The Timex Sinclair 1000 is more in line with the predecessor to the ZX Spectrum. So it's not the same as the ZX Spectrum. It's older. And okay. I believe it doesn't have – it's. I think it's only monochrome, for instance, and it has 8K of RAM. It's significantly weaker than the ZX Spectrum. Yes, you have to say ZX, apparently. I've never understood that.
You do.
I'm an American. You know.
Our European cohorts and yeah, I think, Michael, you
and
also.
Australia would also say it.
Yeah, you'll keep us honest on the Z.
We say it correctly down here.
So if you see a striped horse, it's a zebra. A zebra. That's where it gets confusing to me.
You know, I saw your Commodore build that you made back in, you know, a while back.
And yeah, it was about 5 years ago.
This is getting to actually be a few years ago. And there was an Apple II GS, I think, and some other things. Out of those other builds that you made, do you have any funny stories or big challenges or, you know, cool discoveries or, you know, any kind of interesting behind-the-scenes stuff?
Well, with the Commodore, yeah, strangely enough, Commodore was the first 8-bit computer I made a laptop version of, which is weird because I didn't even have a Commodore when I was a kid. But I think someone wanted it, and it took me a while, and I started – it kind of had like this red racing stripe, and I had this design, but it just wasn't working, and it wasn't working. And at a certain point, I was like, you know what? I spent like a year like tinkering with it, and I'm like, this sucks. And so I just completely started the design from scratch, and then it was awesome. I mean, that's probably my second favorite. My absolute favorite was the Atari 800 that I did. Not just because I had an Atari 800 when I was a kid, but it had the keyboard that popped up. because laptops, the keyboards are always flat, but on a computer, the keyboard is always in an angle. I'm like, well, why can't it pop up and be at an angle? So that was a feature that I put into the final Atari 100 laptop that I built, which was in, like, I don't know, 2009.
Yeah, that was really neat.
I think one of my Commodores actually ended up at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. So I don't know if it's on the floor, but I heard one of them was donated. But yeah, so my idea with that one was I designed it and it wasn't working. I was trying to make it work, and I'm like, you know what? I just have to ditch everything. I have to get a new LCD, because finding LCDs is actually probably 90% of the trouble when you do these things. Like, we even have the trouble now. Like, we're doing like an Xbox. It's like an Xbox One tablet sort of thing we're doing next week, and it's really difficult because nowadays they don't make computer monitors any smaller than 20 inches, which is enormous if you think about something that's supposed to be a laptop. Or NTSC is pretty much dead. Well, it's not dead, but anything that's going to be NTSC is going to be some piece of garbage screen from China that has like an inverter and all this stuff. So, you know, the LCD is thin, but all the electronics on it are thick. Mm. So you have to look at things like I'll go on Amazon and I'll look at the product listings, and the trick is you want to see an external power brick, because that means you can just stick DC voltage into the LCD and it doesn't need much else. Because if the power brick or the, you know, AC-DC circuitry is integral to the LCD screen, that means all those transformers and capacitors are going to be right behind the screen, making everything thicker. It's better to have that an completely external brick.
So it'd be more like a suitcase at that point than a laptop.
Yes, exactly. There was this wonderful screen I found. It was a 16-inch VGA, I think it's like the company's Hand G. I think you can still get them off Tiger Direct. It was LED backlit, which is also something you want to look for because it takes up less energy than CFLs. But it was VGA only, which means you can't use it with, you know, a modern console, because like the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, they both had HDMI as well as analog, so you could get SCART off of them, VGA, all sorts of stuff. Now it's all HDMI or bust. Yeah, so anyway, those problems still exist today, and they were just as bad like 6 years ago. Well, you can't even hardly get miniature LCDs at all anymore. The only thing you can really find are like cheap backup cameras off Amazon. Because what's the point? Who would buy a small screen? Like, cell phones have taken over everything.
That's true. Yeah. We look for them every now and then in the retro computing hobby, because if you're going to be carting your retro computer and all this to a club meeting or something like that, it's just a pain in the neck to be dragging along a 24-inch monitor along with you. So we look for the smaller ones that have NTSC or you never find an RGB, but...
Oh, no.
But,
and then a lot of people are always like, oh, well, can I just rip the screen off of my portable DVD player? And no, you can't.
You can't, actually.
Or an old laptop. That's the big one. Oh, my God. I could pay off the national debt if I got a dollar. It's like, all you have to do is, if you want to ask me if you can use an LCD from an old laptop, just send me a dollar along with the request, and they'll send it to the federal government, and yeah, we'll be paid off.
Deficit like, gone. Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane how many... I understand why people want to do that, but it just doesn't work. Well, it's not that it doesn't work. It's not worth the time.
Well, you have to reverse engineer whatever kind of protocol or method they use.
Yes, and every one is different.
Right.
Yes.
And probably make some sort of bit-banging method to... Yeah,
well, they're all differential signaling now. They sell adapters, but it's just not worth it. Just buy an $80 LCD off Tiger Direct. I mean, I'm all for reusing things and recycling things, but not when it isn't worth the time.
Right.
Unless you want to do it, there's like, I guess my problem is I always think of things from like a commodity production standpoint. It's not worth my time to dink around with just trying to figure out how something works, because I just have to get the project done. However, if you just want to have a fun weekend project where you try to figure out how to get an LCD work, if that's your ship in a bottle or if that's your building dollhouses or tinker toys, then go for it. But for me, I just don't have the time.
Now, you mentioned that maybe one of your Commodore builds had gone to the Computer History Museum. We're curious about all your builds, actually. So once one of your masterpieces is done, you know, you got this thing done,
yep.
Where do they go? Is there some amazing Ben Heck closet somewhere? Like, you open it up and, you know, it's where Geraldo Rivera is going to, like, find that someday? Or
I'm old enough to remember when that was on TV. You're so embarrassed.
I definitely watched it. I'm Geraldo Rivera reporting from the archaeological find of Ben Heck's closet.
the thing that's funny is like that was a touchstone of. I don't know what the word would be, fallacy, let's just say. It's like, you know, oh, this TV celebrity spent, you know, all evening finding nothing. And, everyone, like, just still, they still remember that, right? But now, like, 80% of television is, like, looking for ghosts, Bigfoot, hidden treasure. it's funny that we make fun of that, but, like, television is, like, 90% that now. I guess that's off the subject. As far as, like, where this stuff ends up, well, usually anything I build, there's a purpose for it. Like someone has asked for it. So all those cool laptops you're talking about from like 5 or 6 years ago, every one of those was built on commission. So as soon as they're done, they're shipped off. I guess my joke is like, if I couldn't sell these things, I couldn't afford to keep building them because of my joke. And quite honestly, once I'm done with stuff, I usually don't care anymore. For me, it's more about building it than having it. So I'm usually more than happy to send it on its merry way. Although I was kind of sad to give up the Spectrum. I think we gave that to like the UK Register for a giveaway, but I wouldn't have mind, you know, keeping that one, but I could always rebuild it.
Well, so I alluded to this when we started the conversation, but your popularity on YouTube, your show, and also just in general broadcasts about electronics, you know, like another one that comes to mind is the Amp Hour podcast and things mm-hmm. that have to do about electronics. They're very popular these days. So do you see a similarity between you grew up in the 80s, so
oh yes.
Do you see a similarity between today's maker movement and the computer hobbyists from the 70s and the 80s, back when computers were hard and when they were fun?
Honestly, I don't see a lot of similarity, and I say that because it's much bigger now than it ever was back then. I mean, remember, that was back when being a geek wasn't cool. You know, you weren't cool if you were a geek. So you were relegated to the basement, playing your Dungeons and Dragons on your VIC-20 and all this jazz. But now, you know, we have like a White House Maker Fair, and the Maker Fairs are attended by tons and tons of people. And it's, I don't know, I think if anything, it's better than it ever was. The internet makes it great. Like, think about it, like in the 80s, I had like 2 books. Regarding like computers and stuff, that was it. And they didn't have stuff like that at the library, really. Or if they did, they were incredibly generalized, you know, like program in BASIC. And then at the bottom of the cover, it'd be like, works on Atari, Commodore, and Microsoft.
Right. And Timex Sinclair 1000.
Yep, which of course in your brain immediately equals, oh, there will be no graphics because it can't generalize across the platform. So it'll just be like, you know, bog standard Microsoft BASIC. Yeah, but nowadays you have the internet, you have Wikipedia, you have YouTube. I mean, I far and away learn way more on the internet than I ever did in school, just in the time the internet's been really popular. And also when people build something, they can get their work out there. It's like, oh, look, I built a ham radio dial phone for my Amstrad CPC. I'm going to take it to the computer hacker meeting and show 5 other people. Nowadays, it's like you put it on YouTube and you get like 100,000 hits. I would say there's thematic comparisons, but otherwise, I would say it doesn't even compare. It's so much better now.
No, I love that answer. So, it's better today. It's a very cool answer. So,
it's like saying when people travel around in their horse and buggy in the Old West. Oh, that was so romantic. Oh, horse and buggy. Is that better than travel today? Well, maybe compared to airlines, yes, it was. But in general, no.
Well, the neat thing about that is it's an optimistic answer. I'll tell you why. Sometimes I have 2 teenagers myself. Sometimes I feel a bit sorry for them. They're jaded to the extent that we talked about earlier, that the entire internet is at their fingertips
mm-hmm.
on their cell phone.
Yeah.
But by the same token, you've got a much broader, these days, availability of maker type events and technical information, like you say, on the internet. And if you're into that kind of thing, the barriers to entry are not nearly as high as they were. So it's a very optimistic viewpoint. I like that.
Yeah, actually, that makes you think of another statement. I mean, there were, you know, consumer electronics show has been around for I don't know, what, 30 years, if not more. But it's industry only. You can't just go to it, right? Same thing with E3. That's been around for 25 years, but you can't just go to it. But now, yes, these conventions and or like Penny Arcade Expo, although I would never recommend going to that. That is like insane and not in a good way. Or the Maker Faires, like the same kind of things, like where a bunch, like you go to the, they're all vendor sponsored, of course, because they have to be. But it's like if you want to see the latest stuff from TI or Atmel or ARM or whatever, you go to one of these shows and there they are. You don't have to be an insider to go to CES or press. You can just do it and it's accessible. And it's cool because like for the kids, everything, well, a lot of the things that are demonstrated are done in such a way to excite kids. You know, kids don't give a flying F about a microcontroller or something, but you hook it up to a robot or hook it up to a Lego, and then they get excited. And that's also good to see because, you know, personally speaking, I think for many, at least two decades in America, at least, all anyone ever did was IT and healthcare. And I think we need to, like, you know, start breeding some more engineers. And it's good to see young kids excited about that because eventually they're all going to be dead. The engineers, I mean. And we need more.
Yeah, I couldn't possibly agree more on that. It's, and, you know, the pivot to STEM education and things like that, it's just all, it's good. It's good stuff. And I love it because I'm a hobbyist in that world. Speaking of which, you're right in the thick of it. So,
the thick of it?
Yeah, the thick of all of this, you know, the electronics hobbying and the maker stuff. So you'd be really qualified to answer this question. And we always talk about this on the RCR and other things. If somebody wants to get into that world, into the maker world, the electronics hobby world, what are some of the first resources that you'd recommend to them? How do they get in their foot in the door? Because, you know, I think today we almost have the danger of information overload. So what would you tell somebody who says, I want to get into this stuff?
We just did an episode the other day. It was our double up week because we had to double up in order to take Christmas off. And we did an episode. It was Raspberry Pi versus microcontroller versus discrete logic, where we talked about the difference and how it would apply to your project. The question you just asked, I get asked a lot. That's big part of being famous. You just get asked the same things over and over and over. One thing I've noticed is, yeah, with the information overload that you mentioned, people tend to like throw everything at it. Like, oh, I need to make a blinking light. I'll buy a Raspberry Pi, which is overkill. I usually suggest people start with Arduino. If you're into like hacking and stuff, Arduino is like ubiquitous. It's like the 6502 of modern day. There you go. I used your computer reference. You know, you can use that and you can bridge to anything because, you know, you can control things with it. It programs in C, which obviously is like the biggest language ever. And of course, watch the Ben Heck Show. It's a great way to get into the hacker movement. Although people will watch the show and then email in, how do I get started? So I don't also say if you're
going to... See, we're trying to preemptively help you with that question.
Another thing I usually tell people is like, think of one thing you want to do and do the one thing. Like, don't start doing 10 things at once because you'll never finish. And once you pick the one thing you want to do, it's like, ooh, I want to make my TRS-80 Model 100 talk to my modern PC. Like, pick a goal and then buy the minimum amount of things that will help you accomplish that goal. You know, you don't need to buy all this fancy equipment necessarily to do something. Just build up to it. I mean, I'm always getting more equipment, but you know, I used to just have basically a soldering iron and a pair of tweezers. Always gotta have the tweezers, though. That's item number one.
Tweezers are a big deal.
Oh, I was really impressed. Yeah, so I finally got a Trash 80 Model 100, and it was really simple to connect it to a modern computer. I was impressed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, the disk drive protocol for that was really simple. So making a little hack of software that would simulate the disk drive, it's pretty trivial. It was a lot of fun to play with those things, too.
Yeah, and the internal RS-232, it was TTL level, so it was like 0 and 5 volts, and it just had external circuitry that bumped it up to positive 12 and negative 12. So yeah, if you just cut one line, you can plug it right into a modern UART and bam. And yeah, you can save programs over the serial port. It's insane. That thing was really ahead of its time. I love it.
Yeah, they're really popular still these days. I guess the journalists really like them because you could slap in 4 AA batteries and go out to your site and do all your reporting and then modem it in.
So, yeah, and the keyboards are really nice on them, too.
Yeah.
It was one of the last computers that Bill Gates personally wrote software for, like, yeah, that many years ago. But anyway, going back to your other question, which I think I forgot. Oh, yeah, getting started with stuff. It's easier than it ever was, but yeah, you're right. There's a risk of information overload. So, yeah, think of something that you want to do. Like, I want to do this. How do I do it? Instead of, like, I want to learn everything. Because, well, at least for me, like, learning through necessity or, like, I need to accomplish this goal. I need to learn how to do this. That's the best way I learn. And I can't think there aren't others that learn that way as well. So, yeah. Yeah, pick a goal. Like, I want to automatically water my plants while I'm on vacation. Just something like that. And then just have a laser-like focus. And then once you've figured it out, you can branch on other things.
I think that's actually really good advice. On one of the hobby forums that I'm on, we call distractions the squirrels. And say, you know, once you've built up critical mass of your electronics hobby stuff or retro computing, like Paul was mentioning, Paul has too many retro computers. We've had to cut him off from eBay and do an intervention. But
what's the most obscure retro computer you have?
That I have? That's a good question. I have a Jupiter 2, which is a very old. I don't even know what kind of processor
it
runs. 6800 maybe. It doesn't work yet, but it's a big box. You know, sort of S100 type. you know, shape. That's probably the weirdest one I have.
I was gonna say I kind of wanted to find like an old Zenith TV with a knob on it and hook my Atari up to it. Create like 1980s world. Like in a corner of my home.
You'd need the paint and the sofa, though.
I probably won't.
Shag carpeting.
I tell you, one of my customers, like, I don't know, 4 years ago, I can't remember what he bought or what he wanted, but he's like, I'm going to send you something special, extra, Ben. And he sent me a NIB, a new inbox, Atari 1050 disk drive, and it still had the paper inside of the disk drive that's the shape of a disk. It's like, remove this before using. Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's neat when you let out the 80s. We call it letting out the 80s air. Open one of those things.
I actually bought two of those cartridges from the Atari dump.
Oh, really?
Oh, I did. I was one of the idiots that did that.
No, that's awesome. I just watched
I'm gonna
that.
I'm going to unbox it and see if they still work. I'm going to unboxing.
Did you see the documentary?
Yeah, is it free to download now?
It is. Yep.
Is that because Microsoft Studios went under? Ha, ha, ha.
I don't know.
Do you have to load that off the Xbox, or how do you get it?
No, you get it on your PC. Just Google for Xbox video. You can download it. It was really a good watch.
Well, no, I have an Xbox. I could watch it on my Xbox.
Oh, fun.
Cool. I watched the Angry Video Game Nerd movie recently, and that also involved that landfill. So I'm glad they finally found it and put the rumors to rest.
So how does the cartridge smell?
I haven't got them yet, which kind of pisses me off. Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, they were bulldozed and then covered with concrete. So I don't know if there's that much.
So they probably smell like cement.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe you can do the opening using a hazmat suit or one of those isolation Perspect boxes with the gloves on it.
Oh, yeah. There's like an alien virus that's been down there all these years. And, yeah. I'm not
sure. He wants to go home.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I wonder, before we close the conversation here, do you have any parting shots?
I guess we talked about old computers a lot. That was good.
Yeah, that's kind of our
I got a good question for you guys. What do you think the most underrated old computer was? Like from, like, I don't know, 75 to 89? Or what one do you don't think gets enough credit or love? I guess you could technically say the next, because that was like 89.
Well, last time, I think, was it last time? Sometime recently, the Amiga got a lot of attention in that direction, that it was a very capable computer that was marketed very terribly. And so nobody had one. You know, they were very poorly distributed.
I thought they were really successful. They weren't?
Not commercially successful, no. Commodore
really?
Wound up going out of business in 94, and it was really hard to even try and find an Amiga. I think they might have been more successful in Europe that had a bigger Commodore following than they were in the U.S., but overall, it's pretty universally accepted. They were poorly marketed. It was kind of horrible. Commodore was just running around in circles like a chicken with their head cut off. They had a gold mine. They didn't know how to exploit it.
Yeah, I mean, that thing blew away the Jackintosh. I mean, it was really ahead of its time. And the video production, I remember using video toasters back in the early 90s, and those all ran off Amiga back in the day.
Those were the killer app.
It was actually a really killer graphics video machine. There was nothing else like it out there at the time.
Yeah, it had Genlock and all sorts of stuff, like a blitter. Gosh, I never realized it wasn't that popular. I always assumed it was. Mind blown. Good thing I asked.
I had an Amiga when I was in college, and on a campus of, 1,800 students, there were maybe, 10 of us who had an Amiga. I mean, hundreds with Macs and, probably hundreds also with PCs. But it was just not popular, even amongst young people who otherwise, would be into that sort of thing. Just huge commercial failure. So I'd throw my vote in there, actually, if we're looking at the later part of the retro period. It's the Amiga as the unsung hero of the day.
Yeah, I think the noteworthy thing is that the Amiga popularity might be as solid today as it was back then. The people who were into the Amigas were really into the Amigas, and a lot of it lives on. But yep, that's my vote too. Good call.
I should maybe just plug the Apple III a little bit, but I do a separate podcast on the Apple III, which is another very similar story of
a
good computer.
No, the Apple III, it's sort of like a souped up Apple II, but they had a lot of shipping, a lot of manufacturing problems right at the beginning, and so they couldn't recover from that after the kind of initial failures.
So wasn't the Apple IIgs also pretty unsuccessful?
Not as bad as the Apple III.
Oh,
the Apple III is the one that's sort of famous for the recommended repair being to pick it up off the desk and then drop it back out, back on the desk in order to reseat the chips.
That came out around the same time as a Macintosh too, which probably didn't help.
Right. Yeah. There was no love going in either actually the Apple II or Apple III directions, but the Apple III was basically cut off right around 1984, I think.
Oh wow! It didn't last very long then. Well, that's interesting to learn about the Amiga. Thanks for filling me in.
Yeah, maybe we'll see a build with it someday, huh?
I think that's one of the last computers I haven't worked with. I don't care about the Atari ST. I'm not a musician. Yeah, I'll have to look into that. Oh, well.
I think you'll find that in terms of the circuitry, I mean, it was designed largely by some of the same design team who did the Atari 800 and the Atari 2600 before that.
Yep,
so there's some technical lineage going on there that is probably similar to things you've seen before.
Didn't that same team design the Atari Lynx, which was originally called the Handy?
Perhaps. That I'm not sure of.
That I don't know, but you were right about Jay Miner. Yep.
Yep, he goes all the way back. I don't know if he worked on the 2600, but he definitely worked on the 800. And David Crane, who everyone knows for Pitfall, he wrote the 800's OS. It's like people don't realize they all worked at Atari. So, yeah. Even Steve Jobs worked at Atari once. Everyone worked at Steve Ritchie, the pinball guy, worked at Atari. Yeah. Okay, is there anything else you need to ask me?
I don't think so. I think that's it. It was really fun having you on the podcast. I appreciate you dropping by today and chatting with us. And, I just hope for continued increasing success for your show. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Well, clearly we have to do an Amiga. That's obviously what everybody wants.
Go, 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 go,
we'll
go.
We'll call it the Amigo.
Nice. That's a pretty friendly name.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Very cool. Well, all right. Ben Heckendorn of The Ben Heck Show. We'll have a link for your show in the show notes for episode number 88. And that's it for this episode of the RCR. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. Great community over there for retro computing. Make sure to stop by. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. Feedback can go to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Easy to remember. Please shoot us some feedback. We love it. We're a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, where you can really get your fill of retro podcasts, all kinds of genres. Great place to go if you're pining for your nostalgia. And please, if you enjoy the show, write a review for us on iTunes. Until next time,
Retro Compute.